On this episode of Skeptico,
is that someone there?
Socio-spiritual engineering.
I see you. I'm seeing someone there. I don't think I like this. It's going fine.
Get out!
It's going fine.
Away!
Is that what happened to Whitley Strieber?
This is no good. I can't do this.
Whitley, tell me what you see.
It's almost as if this figure is...
As played by Christopher Walken in the movie version of Communion you just heard.
Into my mind.
Our guest today, Jason Horsley, sure thinks so.
I'm not saying that think tanks for the CIA have just invented all this stuff. On the contrary, that there's something very real that has been co-opted, has been redirected by groups and agencies and different programs. If there is this potential within us as human beings that enables us to discover true autonomy, a true experience of ourselves and our nature within creation, like you said at the beginning, who are we and why are we here? To really uncover that answer as individuals would make us beyond the reach of any kind of control or manipulation or exploitation.
Stay with me for Skeptico. Today we welcome Jason Horsley to Skeptico. Jason is the author of several books, including one that we're going to talk a good bit about today, Prisoner of Infinity. He's also the creator of the extremely interesting Autoculture blog and the Liminalist podcast, again, playing around with this idea of multiple realities, which we all know, of course, is the only reality there is, multiple realities. So, Jason, welcome to Skeptico. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Alex.
So I have so much I would love to talk to you about today. You know, as we were just chatting about a minute ago, I originally contacted you because of a blog post I ran into about Peter Lavenda. And I think there's a lot there that you've dug into. But there's so much more that I don't even know that we'll get around to that. I'm just up to my eyeballs with your work. It's fascinating. It's impressive. And I don't know how we're going to fit it all in. And I don't want to try and cram it all in. But at the same time, I thought, and I've never quite done this before, but I wanted to give people a quick overview of what I thought we might talk about, so that then I can just throw all those notes away and just let it go wherever it wants. But I want to give people an idea of where I'm coming from. So that's kind of a wacky idea. Does that sound okay?
Yeah, that sounds fine. I know exactly what you mean. I mean, I think the main thing is you and I connecting and having a good, enjoyable conversation. And we're not going to hit all the points. But if you cover a whole bunch of them right at the start, then actually we don't really have to hit them because we've just created a backdrop for our conversation.
Yeah, exactly. And I think this is a style that you're comfortable with in terms of your show, in terms of these dialogues that really can and should take a path of their own. You know, the other thing I'll give people a heads up on is, you know, if you're uncomfortable with conspiracy in the general sense of it challenging your beliefs, man, save yourself an hour and a half right now, because forget it. There's just no way to approach. I don't think there's any way to approach any of this material that is of interest to me right now without having that mindset. But that's going to certainly be true here. And the other thing I guess I want to give people a heads up on is I have a ton of respect for your research, and we're still not going to agree on some stuff. And we might really disagree on some stuff, but that's because I'm coming at it from a standpoint of I'm with someone shoulder to shoulder who's really dug in the way that I admire. So it's okay if we don't agree. That's my opportunity to really learn, you know, and that's what I like to explore on the show.
Yeah, well, hopefully my opportunity too. I mean, I got this whole thing about liminalism, which I won't try and sum up too much, but the main thing is uncertainty, and it's the opposite, it's flexibility, the opposite to getting stuck into interpretations, just always leaving them open at both ends if possible. And I think that that's more essential than any other time when you're looking into, as you put it, multiple realities. I mean, that has many different meanings, but specifically in terms of paranoid awareness, as I used to call it, conspiracy research and so on, and the UFO, which I imagine we'll also touch upon. Actually, very particularly with the UFO, there's a tendency of the human mind to try and fix narratives into familiar forms and structures, and that actually goes against the very flow of my interest and your interest, which is about actually entering into areas that are anomalous, that don't fit with the narrative, and that can't be forced to fit. So it's always a mistake, I think, to try and impose our preconceptions on these subjects. And I think that's understood about the UFO by anyone who's researched it, that it definitely overlaps with sort of, more supernatural or more subjective areas. But I think it's also true of conspiracy too, that it's kind of like the worldview that we've been conditioned to have isn't large enough to incorporate these narratives that you start to uncover around conspiracy. Some of them are manufactured, but some of them actually do point to something true. And it doesn't have to entail shape-shifting reptilian aliens or anything that is actually supernatural, but just the extent to which our own perceptions are being manipulated is a mindfuck, pardon my French. You actually can't really think about it or understand it without changing your way of thinking.
Perfectly said, perfect setup. Let me then go over my starting points. So one of the things I like about your work is I think that you are fundamentally tied to the big questions, and you seem to be returning to those in a way that I really get excited about, because that's what it's about. Who are we? Why are we here? Those are the only questions. Those are the only questions of science. Those are the only questions of life. And, you know, I heard a really interesting interview just the other day with Laird Scranton, and I thought he had a great point. Even though he's not a quote-unquote professional scientist, it was the most beautiful explanation of science, and that is, it's like a game of Clue, you know, the old game where it's Professor Custer or whatever his name is with a candlestick in the living room, and then someone lays down a card and says, well, no, here's the living room, so it can't be in there. I think what we're always doing, and I think what your work does, is keep saying, maybe it's not that you're so sure that it is, because I have the card for, you know, the candlestick or whatever. So one of the games of Clue, some of the cards that I think are played is one, we've played the religion card. It's not just what that old book says. And we've played the science card. You know, we're not biological robots in a meaningless universe. We've played that card. But there's a card that's a really, really important card that we haven't quite figured out, and that's the ET card. And I think especially lately, I mean, this is so much what your book is about and this work is about, is can we really put that to bed one way or another and understand what that is? So I'll just tee that up. Then we're going to talk a lot about Whitley Strieber, who I think is an absolutely fascinating character. And I think it's amazing that you put your finger on what I think is such critical person in this whole thing, this whole big picture question that we're talking about. So I look forward to really diving into that in a respectful way. I mean, because we're talking about somebody who is alive and is a real person and has feelings and caring person and all the rest of that. But by the same token, he stepped out there and says, hey, I'm carrying the torch here. And he's kind of invited us to really dive deep into what he's about. And I think we can have an interesting discussion about that. And then the third and final point that I really wanted to talk to you about, because you do such a fascinating job in your book of talking about it, is this idea of socio-spiritual engineering. So we're going to talk about, you know, what it is, how it really works, because I think we might have a little bit of different ideas, but probably not. You know, it's not just that culture is being engineered. We have to then take it to the next level and tease out, you know, how it's being engineered and how it's not being engineered, even though we might be told it's being engineered that way. It's like the third layer deep of the conspiracy stuff. And we'll talk about some other stuff related to that, including the occult and some of your perspectives on that from an insider, from a practitioner, and then also some of your perspective as a spiritual seeker, if you will, because that I thought was really a cool part of your work as well, and something that I, you know, definitely resonate with, because I think, again, you've put your finger on something there too, that there is a limitation to that occulted perspective, or that occult practice perspective, that I think is really, really interesting to explore. So there, I've spent a good deal of time, but I've kind of laid out a lot of stuff.
You sure have. That's quite an impressive menu. That's, where do you want to start then?
Where do we want to start?
I'll tell you something that jumped out at me. It was on the first card, because I can't click back to them now. It was, well, you presented the ET as a card that hasn't been fully explored or played yet, and as, you know, as contrasted with religion and science. And what came to mind was a model that actually I got from this writer, Ramsey Dukes, who's an occultist who I know personally, or I used to know, I should say. He's a very good writer, but at the same time, I'm very suspicious of anyone who practices the occult for reasons that we may get into. But nonetheless, he presented a model for historical cycles, small and large, around this quaternity, if that's the word, the four different methodologies or modes of human consciousness and perception, or cultural, let's say cultural modes: religion, science, art, and magic. And I think there's definitely a lot in them, like those four different modes, if you like, they can be correlated with other quaternities like the elements and so on and so forth. I think this is quite a useful working model. So it occurred to me when you were talking about these different cards that can be played in order to try and use them as lenses, to mix the metaphor here, to through which to perceive reality. And then you presented the ET as one of those cards. And I think that I would say that the ET isn't really a card in himself, but more of a feature on one of these four main cards. The question is which one, and he may actually be a feature that migrates from card to card. And this may be the power of the ET archetype, in fact, because, I mean, my first thought was that the ET most correlates with occultism, because if you trace back occultism, modern occultism, you end up with theosophy, you know, via Aleister Crowley, and you'll find the ET is a recurring theme throughout, like Blavatsky's Ascended Masters, Crowley's Hidden Chiefs, and Iwas. Later, Kenneth Grant reinvented or reinterpreted Crowley through Lovecraft's lens, and basically talked overtly about ETs and UFOs. So this is something that I explored in my earliest writings about UFOs with as Aeolus Caifas, was that the ufology and occultism, they don't just overlap, but they can almost be superimposed one upon the other. This, of course, could bring us to Lavender if we wanted to.
Isn't that kind of a dangerous jump ahead? Let me pull you back. I want you to stay right on that topic. I love that you put your finger on the ET thing. But my intent with that slide was really much more simple-minded, if you will. It was that, in the spirit of where I came from in terms of Skeptico, when I started the show, I still had religious baggage that I was carrying around. You know, could I really let go of the narratives of my childhood, even though they were ridiculous stories on one hand? You know, was there any truth to them? And so it was a step forward for me to check the box and go, literal interpretation of the religion, no. religion as a psyop, yes. So whatever is the spirituality there, I can mine that out later, but I can dismiss that as being an answer to the question. And again, it's kind of a simple-minded approach. And then, you know, you move on to science and you go, okay, and this is the path I think a lot of people follow. And you say, okay, no, here it is. Science, man, we got it. You know, we'll just follow that path. And they don't realize they're buying into yet another dogma, because the scientists don't even realize it, but they're buying into the biological robot meaningless universe meme, and it doesn't make any sense. But here's where I wanted to bring you back to the ET and get your thought about it, because this is really almost recent for me. You know, with the disclosure last year in December 2017 in the New York Times, it's like, okay, all you pigs at the trough, come on up and chow down this, because everything we told you was fake. And maybe you had this doubt in your head of, is it really fake? Is it really real? And you already knew 99% that it was real, but now it's officially real. And that kind of did a head spin for me too, because where it took me was, if these craft, if these unidentified flying objects are moving at 10,000 miles an hour and turning at a right turn, they have a propulsion technology that's way beyond what we could possibly understand. And then it struck me, what if they have a similarly advanced understanding of all this other shit we're talking about, of consciousness, of extended consciousness, of the occulted realm, of the afterlife realm, of all that stuff? And it kind of sent me on this path of, is ET maybe a much bigger part of the big picture question than I personally had really been allowing in? You know, I had kind of compartmentalized it and said it's over here and this and that. And I think you really touch on that, more than touch on it. I think you're all over it in your book, Prisoner of Infinity, and in the work of Whitley Strieber. But in general, does any of that resonate for you?
Well, would you say that, I mean, what you just described for you and why it was such a head turner was that you had, for you, the ET was something that was incorporated or containable within a scientific paradigm, and then you began to see that that was permeable and that it wasn't so loose, it wasn't so fixed as you thought, and that,
you know, not completely, but I love the way you put it, though. It was contained for me in a couple of separate silos. It was contained in the scientific technological silo, and at the same time, it was contained in the extended consciousness silo. You know, hey, Jacques Vallée, they're fairies, they've been with us. It was also the silo of the ancient aliens. Oh, maybe they've come down in genetic engineering, contained in the abduction literature. You know, I've interviewed David Jacobs and Mary Radwell and all those people multiple times. You know, okay, something's happened. But I'm just saying, again, for me, I wasn't able to kind of unsilo all that and say, wait a minute, what if it is coming together at a much bigger level, higher level, hierarchical level, that somehow makes it much more significant than I thought? Do you get what I mean?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I say of course. I mean, I do, like, my early interest in the UFO and the alien abduction was as a, I'd say, an experiencer. Like, I considered myself an experiencer, somebody who had encountered this other layer of reality or of the onion that we exist in, and that I was looking for terms and tools with which to understand it. There was a period where I did get into the literal ET sort of version of it, that they come from Zeta Reticuli, and that really wants to reduce it or flatten it out into what I would say is a scientific paradigm, albeit an expanded scientific paradigm. But I never really was able to fully, I would say, submit to that narrative, you know, to that interpretation, partly because my experiences themselves were so very subjective. Like, I would encounter these beings, I have to do the air quotes there, because to this day I don't know what I encountered or whether it's be correct to term it beings or not, but in, you know, half awake, half dreaming states, quasi memories of another life or of childhood or of another self in, you know, parallel existence and so on and so forth, was something about the nature of the experience or the encounters that themselves unhinged my sense of my identity and my reality. So in that sense, they really did seem to have a spiritual dimension to them. You know, I would say that still to this day, those experiences have some realities for me. There's something going on at a deep psychological level for me and for all of us, and that the ET archetype intersects with that. But what Prisoner Infinity addresses, and what it took me that long to really start addressing, to what extent has the narrative actually been cynically manufactured to superimpose on top of a reality that simply can't be reduced, but that we will go along with that. We will conspire unconsciously and become complicit with the reduction of an experience and an encounter that is trying to pull us out of the prison of our own illusory identity selves and introduce us to a greater reality.
And you know what, Jason, let me interject something, because that's a fantastic point, that socio-spiritual engineering. But I have to tell you, that came through even stronger for me in the non-UFO stuff. And I don't know if we want to jump into that now, but like the examples in the co-opting of the New Age movement, you know, is kind of an example. And I think, I don't know if you're totally comfortable with the parallels, but the methods for socio-spiritual, which is what you're adding to it, the spiritual, the socio-spiritual engineering, are all over the place. And it's almost like they have the playbook, they bring it out, they just kind of run the plays, find out which ones work, and they kind of do it again and again. And it doesn't, to me, this is my read of it, I'm maybe jumping ahead, but it doesn't matter if it's ET or if it's New Age or if it's psychedelics, it's the same shit. You know, Gloria Steinem, women's movement, oh no, we know how to do that. Boom, you know, Gloria Steinem outed as CIA lifetime actor. And then when she's outed, she comes out and says, oh yeah, but I did it because I had to help the women and I really believed in the cause and the CIA was the only way to do it. Again, it sounds like this scripted kind of thing. If I can kind of jump subjects, and I got a promise that we'll come back to the other one, but I think it almost makes it more clear when you talk about the socio-spiritual engineering in some of these other areas where you can really kind of put your finger on it and go, that happened, and it doesn't make any sense if you don't look at it from a conspiratorial point of view.
Yeah, true. But I think you can do that with the UFO. I mean, you can find specific individuals who are, you know, spiking the ground and poisoning the well. But I also, I mean, I don't have any problem with superimposing the two or conflating the two, because I think that they are one psyop, if you will. But having said that, you know, one cultural operation that, you know, has many of the same players and many of the same themes and even narratives, sort of, it's a bit like that movie Rashomon by Kurosawa, where you have this event and then you see four different installments of four different individuals involved in the event. Remember it differently. It's the same event, but it's seen from four different perspectives. So I'd say that you could say that about the UFO and the ET and the abduction, that whole mimetic memeplex, to coin a phrase, and, you know, New Age channeling entities and, you know, past lives and all the stuff that is more immediately associated with New Age belief, that it's kind of the same archetypal mix, just arranged differently to appeal to different sensibilities. So the ET does appeal to geeks, to science nerds, to Star Trek fans, whereas New Age would appeal more to, you know, hippies, children of hippies, fallen Christians, or, you know, ex-Christians and so on. It depends. Again, I think you can, it's a useful model to look to think that there are types that are more intuitive, so they would perhaps be more the religious types. There's more intellectual types, they would be more science-based. There's more sensory types, they might be more into magic. There's more emotional types, they might be more artistic, let's say, just to.
And that's all great. But what I really wanted you to drive home for people, because it really was helpful to me, is some like concrete examples of that. And that's why my mind sprung to the New Age thing, because you're kind of pointing out, hey, all this stuff is hatched out of, you know, Northern California, and all of a sudden we see, boom, these connections with this and this connection with this. And so can you give people a sense for the where your research has kind of pinned down some pretty specific, hard to deny connections that support that idea that New Age was, if not completely co-opted, engineered to whatever extent they could?
Yeah, well, I think co-opted is the term, because I don't think it was created whole cloth. I think there was something emerging, and that was anticipated and to some extent, yeah, co-opted and redirected down pre-prepared channels so that it could be controlled. So the obvious example in the context of Prisoner Infinity is the Changing Images of Man document from 1974, which was edited by Willis Harmon, was the main character, but also worked on by a whole bunch of some well-known researchers and scientists, Joseph Campbell being the most famous, Margaret Mead being another, and how that book documents a program, if you will, by which to seed different beliefs within the culture and to water other already existing beliefs in order to create different movements or support different movements and different trends and interests that would, well, one of the focuses would be to replenish and prolong the capitalist machinery of culture, so, you know, in order to give it a renewed life.
Well, just keep things going, keep the machine going the way that it is. I always bristle at the idea of capitalists, because then it kind of gets us into another realm. This is a control and protect kind of idea. So let's keep things where we can control it, and let's, for the most part, kind of protect the flock when we have to, and when we have to prune a couple out. But because this is going to tie into a lot of things, a lot of other things that people listening to this show will be familiar with. I mean, the whole Laurel Canyon thing is connected to this, the whole psychedelic and the electric Kool-Aid acid test kind of.
Right. Well, I mean, to be honest, I don't feel like I'm really the go-to guy there. Actually, there's somebody like John Irvin is all over this and has been for years. And I feel as
though... Yeah, but it's John Irvin, so we can't really kind of go there.
but you know what I mean. I mean, there are certainly people in Dave McGowan, as you mentioned, who've really done, you know, covered it from all the different angles. I was actually... I don't know if I had bigger or smaller fish to fry, but I wasn't directly going after that. It fell into my lap, and it was useful as an example of the way in which I would say that counterfeits are created in order to deceive us and get us. Well, it has two effects. One is, you know, it gets us using the false currency, so we're actually not going to really be having contact with the real thing. But it also devalues the thing that's being counterfeited. So this is, I think, a key point. And I know I haven't really given the examples as you asked, but maybe I'll come back to that. But to me, it's very key to understand that my approach isn't debunking. It's not a debunker. And I'm not saying that these principles or these beliefs or these philosophies are necessarily false. I'm not saying that think tanks for the CIA have just invented all this stuff. On the contrary, that there's something very real that has been co-opted, has been redirected by groups and agencies and different programs for various different reasons, one being, of course, just to exploit it, like the spiritual potential of the psyche or psychic potential of the human body. That has all kinds of uses that can be weaponized, but also to anticipate if there is this potential within us as human beings that enables us to discover true autonomy, a true experience of ourselves and our nature within creation. Like you said at the beginning, who are we and why are we here? To really uncover that answer as individuals would make us beyond the reach of any kind of control or manipulation or exploitation.
Kind of a Gnostic kind of thing, you're saying.
Well, actually, that's a whole can of worms, because the Gnostic thing, I used to be very in line with that, but I've begun to see the Gnostic thing as another example of a counterfeit, I feel. So it is very subtle, but But yeah, in certain senses, the Gnostic sense of having direct knowledge of reality and uncovering the heaven within us and that, yes, in that very strict and straightforward sense, each of us has our own connection to the divine. And if we were to uncover that, then we would be on beyond the reaches of control of, you know, these different groups and organizations. So you'd see how it's key and critical.
I love what you just said there, Jason. I want to highlight that to people because it's the point where a lot of people throw up their arms and just give up when you say, you know, Gnosticism, you go, yeah, well, but maybe I feel like that's been co-opted some ways too. And people go, oh my God, this guy's just, everything's a conspiracy in this life. It's like, that's, I think, a contribution that you're making here that I was trying to put my finger on, is that, of course, again, it's the playbook, man.
What exactly, yeah.
Pops up, we just throw the shit at it and see what we can do. How hard is it to co-opt the Gnostic thing and to throw it in this movie or promote that movie, and all of a sudden we have a hook in it. We don't know where it's going to go, but we know we can do something with it or the other. That's why I love the Gloria Steinem example. That's not from your book. It's from another guest that we've had, Joseph Atwell. But the point is the same. It's like, yeah, but why would the CIA care about the women's movement? And moreover, wasn't it a kind of a good thing? I mean, women were being disenfranchised, underpaid, all the rest of stuff. It's like, they don't fucking care. They just want part of that action wherever it goes. Same with psychedelics, same with this. So I think what you've put your finger on is really important. I think you're right about Gnosticism. And I'll let you now, because I'm sorry I pulled you off, return to talking about UFO ET, because what your insight brings us is that at every turn now, we have to be paranoid, because we have to assume that the playbook is happening at every way we want to look at this. If we want to look at it, the scientific, real spacecraft, Stan Friedman kind of way, it's in play there. If we want to look at it in the Jacques Vallée and fairies, it's in play there. If we want to look at David Jacobs and abductions, it's sure as hell in play there. It's in play all over the place. Then maybe at some point we'll return to Whitley Strieber as kind of this character that runs the gamut. He runs the gamut and runs the gauntlet through all of those, which is just fascinating.
Well, you know, Alex, like you said, the nature of the dilemma that we're in is that pretty much anything, any part of culture that you choose to analyze, you're going to find ways in which there's been hooks put in it and you know, landmines and snares and traps and all the rest of it. So in a certain sense, it would be insane, or it would be foolish to think that we could just analyze the whole of culture and figure out what's going on, you know, one piece at a time. There's no end to it. It's the whole of existence in a certain sense. And this is what corresponds with the spiritual path of neti neti, as in not this, not that. We just keep proceeding through existence, seeing the illusory nature of the things around us, until eventually we change the direction of our attention and place it fully inward and discover that what thou art that. You know, I'm just summing up the spiritual quest there in a very short time. But my general point here is that all of my researches and explorations, they're not about naming the bad guys. They're not even about mapping the conspiracies so that we can address them or change anything. They're about actually developing a tool set, a set of eyes and ears and senses by which I will be able to discern better and better in my daily life what is real and what's unreal. So I don't really necessarily, I mean, I do care about Whitley Strieber because he had such an impact on me, so it was very personal to me. Like, I felt that I was very indoctrinated with the ideology of the ET, and this is point I wanted to get to about the way in which these things are co-opted. It's not as simple as top down or outside in. It's inside out. It's the way the narratives, they can have all the same elements that are basically true, let's say the ET or the New Age, but they're arranged in such a way with a subtext or a context or a connected tissue which is ideological. So then the narratives, although they're playing out, it's like a movie, you know, you enjoy the plot, but somehow you sense, wait, I'm being propagandized here. It's not just about Dirty Harry killing the bad guy. Dirty Harry represents the US state, and Scorpio represents, you know, the youth or the hippie movement or whatever it is. And this is all a metaphor and we're being propagandized. I'd say that you can find this in the ET, you can find this in the New Age, you can find it even in conspiracy theories. There's a subtle ideological thrust. And that, and because we've already been indoctrinated with that ideology, then the narrative with its ideological subtext interacts or you know, gloms onto our conditioning, and we're just feeding the beast. We're just oiling the machines of our own imprisonment. And so it never really works if you just keep letting. It's the same thing to say about the UFO. How are you going to figure out what's going on with the UFO when all the evidence is coming from the UFO? So if the UFO is deceiving us, well, it's the magician. If you look, the closer you look at the magician, the more you're going to get tricked because he knows how to direct your attention. So that's the level of the game that we have to learn to play at. We have to develop the tools to actually direct our own attention rather than let it be directed by the thing that we're looking at.
That's excellent. And I don't disagree with any of that. You know, let me just, for the sake of being skeptical,
yeah,
kind of poke into that a little in a way that doesn't really contradict what you're saying, but I think adds a different shade to it that I don't see talked about a lot. And that's that the conspiratorial / paranoid perspective, I think sometimes leaves out another reality of kind of a how the world works reality. And one of the things I want to play around with is this, you can't handle the truth, kind of Jack Nicholson, A Few Good Men, you know, which there's an essential truth to that we need to talk about, right? So he stands up there and he says, you can't handle the truth. You know, I have men that stand on a wall because you at night sleep better knowing that I'm up there defending you. And that's fucking the truth. You know what I mean? We can't handle the fact that we don't want Chi-Com to roll down the streets and take stuff over, no matter what our political flavor is. But there's that side of it that I think comes into play, is that we've given up some control. We've kind of turned a blind eye because we can't handle the truth. But there's also this other part of it is, you know, you don't deserve the truth. And what I always think about is, I did a show a while back with Jim Mars, who has left us, but was such a great, interesting guy, no matter what you thought of him. And he did so much great work on conspiracy stuff before it was even real. But we talked about Donald Rumsfeld. Y'all remember the old Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of State, the guy who brought us Diet Coke. Aspartame was a completely, the FDA had to, couldn't fall asleep on that and said, no, we can't let that stuff through. That's total cancerogenic crap. And Donald Rumsfeld said, hey, I know some people. You make me the CEO, I'll get that through. And he did. And he was rewarded with tens of millions of dollars. And then later he became Secretary of State. But I digress, because the real story of Donald Rumsfeld is when 9/11 happens, a year later, Donald Rumsfeld says, Building 7? What's Building 7? So it slipped past a lot of people, but I latched on to that. That is, you don't deserve the truth. It's like, look, if you are stupid enough to believe that I don't know what Building 7 is, that I don't know a lot of shit that you don't know, if you're stupid enough to swallow my crap, then you don't even deserve. You're not even in the game. You're such a peon. That's what he's signaling. That's what he's saying. And to the people who do know, who throw up their arms in frustration, he's saying, screw you. I'm here and you're there. You're a peon. You can't touch me. I'm going to stand up here and say, Building 7? What's Building 7? All the Joe schmoes out there, all the normies that say, I don't know what Building 7 is. That's okay. I'm with them. That was a bit of a rant there, but tell me what you think about kind of deconstructing a little bit that justified paranoia that we all have associated with conspiracies.
Well, I think what you just described there, and one of the things that occurs to me is that it feeds into the polarization, because I'm sure you're aware, I mean, doing this, the show that you do, and the climate that we're in now with Trump and all that, and the polarization has always been present around conspiracy theory or conspiracy fact as well, of course, but it's only getting greater. And what you described there with Rumsfeld, I mean, it occurred to me that that actually is a way to intensify the polarization, because there are a whole bunch of people who are contemptuous of, you know, 9/11 truthers or whatever. And when they hear Rumsfeld say something like that, they'll have a big laugh and say, look, even Rumsfeld doesn't know what they're talking about. You know, that Building 7 is so irrelevant that even Rumsfeld, you know, that they will go along with Rumsfeld's kind of acting, his performance, whether or not they believe it, or whatever level of consciousness they're at, it gives the mockers and the deriders and the debunkers validation.
Absolutely.
While at the same time, it's obviously having the opposite effect on those who've done the research, including those who have, you know, maybe haven't done the research, but just believe it because they believe it. Like, let's not fool ourselves. There are a bunch of conspiracy theorists and different, you know, groups and websites and the rest of it that are very, you know, non-rigorous. And
don't get me wrong, Lucas, and I don't want to go on and on, but my real point was that there's something beyond misinformation going on here. There's a game-playing aspect to it that you're alluding to, because I think what Donald Rumsfeld is saying is, fuck you. He's saying, fuck you. Of course, yeah. I know what it is, and I don't, you know what? I don't need to tell you the truth. So to the idiots who just think, oh, yeah, it must not be true, he's not talking to them. He's talking to the people who say, how can you possibly think you can get away with this? And he's saying, fuck, yes, I'm getting away with this. Screw you.
Well, I think you wouldn't want to underestimate, you know, the levels at which someone like Rumsfeld is operating. Like, he's not just throwing things out for his own ego satisfaction or to get a dig in at people. It's all, you know, perception management. So a comment like that would be written and scripted and, you know, acted out to have precise effects, right? Which would include the ones that you're talking about, but not be, you know, restricted to them.
That's a good point. So if you want to continue on that, please do, because you can't overplay that, because he's in a box too, in terms of, you know, how much he can really play the game versus how much he has to follow his script and, yeah, get out there and, you know, George Bush standing in front of the UN saying, you know, we shall not believe in these conspiracy theories. You know, I mean, that's signaling on all this stuff is multi-layered, but.
Yeah. And I mean, your original point with the Jack Nicholson speech is that there are two different rationales these people have. One of them is noble, in quotes, if delusionally noble, as in people aren't ready to hear the truth. They need to be protected from the truth, or at least the truth needs to be protected from them. And then the other, which is not so noble, is, you know, people are just ignorant fools. But it's similar and the same in certain ways. They can't be trusted with the truth because they don't have the discernment to know what it is, never mind to know what to do with it.
One has a certain psychopathic element to it that, you know, we have to just, that word gets thrown around a lot, but we have to acknowledge that that's real. There are some people, psychologically, we can measure them and say they just do not have that sense of empathy. And in a lot of these situations, that makes them extremely powerful in terms of, you know, if you really don't care about other people, and if you really think that in this narcissistic, getting my way is all that really matters, there's a huge edge, the power that goes with that, because most of us just can't do that at the end of the day.
Well, something Graham Greene wrote, which I always remember, just the English writer, he said something to the effect that those who love humanity don't give a damn about human beings. And I think that something more like that is going on with what we're often terming psychopaths, as in these very high power figures who are directing society, you know, down all kinds of roads that seem really destructive and deceptive and all the rest of it, and exploitative. I do think, like the obvious, you know, cliche example, Adolf Hitler, that they tend to have very lofty goals, and they tend to believe that they're pursuing some higher end, that any kind of means are justified in order to achieve it. And I think that's also inseparable from this thing of the belief that people can't handle the truth, that most people don't have the overview of the global situation that the social engineers have. Most people, because they've, of course, we've not been given the tool set. We've not been allowed to have that viewpoint. So it's a bit of a circular reasoning there. You know, part of the rationale behind keeping most people in the dark and manipulating them and treating them like cattle, it's a self-fulfilling rationale, let's say. And the more that people are kept in the dark, the less tools they have for understanding reality, or social reality even, I mean, just at that level, the more in the dark they're going to become, right? So it basically accelerates, it intensifies. And that intensifies also the investment that people have at an individual and a collective level of not seeing the truth. And I think this is becoming more and more observable in our society now, with the polarization around conspiracy theory, that you will encounter people, I'm sure you have often, and I do constantly, who simply want to talk about conspiracy theory as if it was one thing, and as if it was all equally dismissible. They will ignore and completely overlook the fact that some conspiracy theories are not theories at all. They're just part of history. They're just conspiracy facts. And then that there are plenty of facts around conspiracy that one can theorize about, but one doesn't have to. One can just stay with the fact, and so on. There's a spectrum. There's a conspiracy spectrum ranging from historical fact to, you know, the most lunatic, fringe, speculative, flat earth stuff, right? Not to discount flat earthers, they could be right for all I know, but you know what I mean, right?
Let's go ahead and discount flat earth. I hate the neutrality that people want to,
or whatever it is, right?
Avoid pissing
there's
off.
There's different levels, you know. But the thing that's consistent throughout many, if not most, of these conspiracies is they do provide evidence that our leaders are not to be trusted, that our social reality is not what it appears to be, that our institutions do not have our interests at heart, that, you know, organized pedophile rings might be abusing our children if we send them off to daycare, and so on, that the food might be designed to kill us, and so on. I mean, I could go on and on, right, about all of it. But basically, all of these things, if people start to take them on board and really think about them, they're going to become less and less secure and stable within their day-to-day lives. They're already feeling destabilized, right? I think that this is all quite deliberately orchestrated, not at a micro level, but at a more macro level, and then it filters down to the micro. So even down to entertainment, like the entertainment we like.
I get your point. I kind of feel like you kind of mixed a couple things in there in an interesting way that I'd like to pull back apart. I mean, okay. I think the whole pedo thing is super important and interesting. We've talked about it a bunch on this show. You know, it's the Pizzagate phenomena where perfect psyop, you know, where most people think, you know, Pizzagate, it's not about all those emails. It's not about spirit cooking. It's not about provable sex rings and the association between John Podesta and Dennis Hassert. It's not about all that provable stuff. Dennis Hassert, who was deplorable, the judge who sentenced him on sex crimes against children, said he was one of the worst examples he'd ever seen in his court. No, it's not about any of that. It's about some guy who shot up a pizza restaurant. So that's the psyop part of that. But I digress, because what I was really talking about was, I think that's almost of a different ilk. That's because of the whatever dark evilness is there, and whatever political blackmail opportunity is there, and whatever other things are there, that they don't want. They have a different agenda on that, I would say, I would guess, than they do on, you know, fluoridated water and global warming, which it's really kind of more clear to see, hey, anything global in it, we pretty much know what the agenda is. You know, it's like globalization, you know, let's all just become one so we can get you in a big pack and control you better. So without getting into the whole global warming thing, you know, why is it so tied to a worldwide currency and carbon trading? Well, because that makes a sense from a politically driven thing. I don't think there's a parallel with the pedo thing. I mean, I think that you have to look at the occult and just the nature of evil kind of thing in order to get there. And I know those lines aren't perfectly, you know, black and white, but I do think, you know, you have to kind of divide things. And that's like I'm just talking about in the, you know, the get her done, you can't handle the truth. You know, people do have a reason just to kind of get shit done. You know, I mean, somebody's got to rule the world or someone else will rule the world. And if we were faced with the options that some of those people face, we would probably make the same decisions. On the other hand, when you step into the pedo sex ring stuff, we probably would not make the same decisions. Does that any of that resonate with
you? Yeah, I see what you're saying, but it does, I guess it brings it closer to my own hunting ground then, because this is my approach with Prisoner Infinity, and what I found was just unavoidable, which is that all of the different, let's say, global or collective pathologies which can be traced in, you know, big picture stuff like world wars or global, you know, environmental collapses or all of that stuff, you know, on the one hand, it historically intersects with child trafficking, as in with Hillary Clinton and Haiti and all that stuff that also came out via Pizzagate, because the same agendas incorporate various different, you know, areas. So MKUltra was about mind control, which relates to creating different players with on the world stage, whether it's assassins or it's cultural figures and so on. But it also relates to the systemized, organized abuse of children. It also relates to occultism and so on. So all of that, that's quite a wide spectrum in terms of the different areas in the on the world stage that we might see the effects of something like MKUltra. But more specifically or more precisely, what I have found was a fruitful approach for understanding the big picture was actually looking at the motivating drives behind the individuals that can be identified who are shaping the cultural programs and movements and policies. So hence somebody like Whitley Strieber is a very, I mean, anyone really, well, not anyone, but if you're going to try and understand something on a large scale, it's good to narrow the focus down and look at one specific example. Otherwise you get overwhelmed, right?
I want to jump in there and pull apart what you're saying, but there's no need to. I do think it's easy to kind of blur some things together. And I like the model of coming back and saying, you could sell me on some of the evil, some of the stuff that looks like evil in the world. You could sell me on some of the wars. You could sell me on some of the bombing. You could sell me on some of the other despicable looking stuff that goes on because it's a kind of choice between two evils. And then there's another element of it that I could never cross that line morally. And I think there is that wisdom of the crowd kind of dividing line there. And then I think there's these people that, and that's where I think the psychopathic thing comes in, who just transcend way over that in a way where they can kind of play both sides and pull people over to one or the other where people are involved. And that's where we'll get into talking about your experience with the occult thing, because I love how you say, you can say you're not going all the way, but you just get to the point where you're going to cut the cat's throat or not. But I digress again. See all the stuff I would like to talk about. Let's talk about Whitley Strieber. And if you could, let's try this, Jason. Whitley Strieber, from the wonderful Wikipedia kind of overview, high level overview, who he is. And then one layer of the onion down, who he might be with your first layer of analysis. And then we can get into the really deep stuff.
Sure. Okay. So Whitley Strieber, horror fiction writer, who studied with the Gurdjieff Foundation, I guess in the 70s, who was working for an advertising agent. Then he started writing published two horror bestsellers, The Wolf and The Hunger.
So he's successful. He pops on the stage as a successful writer. That's who he is.
Yeah, very, very quickly, like two Hollywood deals with his first two novels. So he would have become rich and a little bit famous right out the gate. And then another novel or two later, he has the communion experience. The alleged, I suppose I should say, communion experience. He writes Communion, which he published in 1987. That was a big success too, like $1 million advance on that. And that was the beginning of his career as Whitley Strieber, as he is known today, the host of Dreamland.
Before we leave that, I mean, Communion, this is a huge event. I mean, let's remember, you know, remind people and remind each other. I remember when Communion came out and his concern, one of his stated concerns was, this is going to trigger a bunch of people. It's mm-hmm. going to cause memories of their own abduction thing. And, you know, we're setting up a whole network because this whole thing is going to happen. And do you remember that whole thing? I mean, Communion was a social movement as much as it was a book, because it was about ET contact being real, being suppressed in people's memories, and that this book was going to bring those to the surface. And it did.
Yeah. And it did, absolutely, yeah. It was, the ground had been tilled, if you like, before that, for a few years with Bud Hopkins, because he'd written at least one book, I guess Missing Time perhaps was his first. And Strieber was sent to Bud Hopkins. Well, I don't know if he was sent. He was referred to Bud Hopkins, and he spoke to Bud Hopkins and met him, and Bud Hopkins hypnotized him. I mean, he did at least one hypnotic session with Bud Hopkins, because there are recordings. So anyway,
those regression sessions, and I learned this through you, that the regression sessions are available on Whitley's website, which I think is incredibly open on his part.
I think so too, and this is something to Strieber's credit, and I think it really strengthens the case for him really being an honest and sincere person so far as he's capable. And I have to add that proviso at the end, because I think that one of the things I discovered looking at Whitley Strieber, and now we get into the second level, is how many contradictions there are in his writings. I mean, they just became overwhelming after a certain point. They began just to be, you know, philosophical contradictions, as in he would have a positive point of view and then a negative, but then they became actual factual contradictions and so on.
So let's jump in there and just do a little bit of a backfill there, because you are getting into some fantastically provocative, interesting stuff that's in the book Prisoner of Infinity. But that's that. So this communion cultural movement happens, and him and Bud Hopkins say it's okay to come out and talk about your abduction experience, and don't worry, we're here for you. And it's like this major thing, and thousands of people are having this. And he's then saying that, you know, the implication is ET is here, ET has something going on there, you know, whether it's transmutation of the species, whatever, we don't know. But this is 1990. That's a long time ago. And
yeah,
days at it. And at some point he becomes somewhat of a joke. I mean, because he gets, for whatever reason, I'd love to get your opinion on that, the meme shifts and it's like, no, he's crazy. He's, you know, he's kind of an outsider. He's not part of the gang. And what's he doing? And even the UFO community is like, who is this guy? What's he about? And then he shifts again and he says, you know what? It wasn't an abduction experience. It was a contact experience. And then he shifts again and says, no, it was a spiritual experience. And I don't even think they were aliens. So he's kind of gone through this very public journey of soul searching. And he is this kind of broken guy. Like you mentioned, when you hear him talk, and maybe we'll play a clip in a minute. Let's do that now. Here's Whitley Strieber on the very excellent Higher Side Chats show with Greg Carlwood. And as you're listening to this, I encourage you to listen deeply. I don't want to cloud your experience too much, but I do want you to be open to not just what Strieber is saying, but also juxtaposing it with what Jason and I are talking about here. Just see if that makes sense as you listen to this and then as you join back into the interview.
You know, I am constantly under pressure, under attack. It never ends, and it never will, as long as I'm alive, And then after I'm dead, I can assure you the debunkers will come out of the woodwork to try to make the truths that I have brought into this world, that we are a much bigger and more extraordinary race of beings than we dare imagine, and that we have a place in the universe waiting for us if we only dare to take our place. They will try to shove that all aside and say to you, you are small, you're insignificant, you are just a physical body, you have no soul, buy more cars, buy more hamburgers, and in the end, this will all settle down to darkness. I urge you to say no to that. Go for the light.
It's hard not to, you know, just kind of like feel that this guy is in such pain, you know? So that I wanted to add to the bio, and now jump back in there with what led you to say, well, okay on all that, but there might be a whole different angle to it.
Yeah, well, he's been at it for a very long time. And to be fair to Strieber, I mean, that spectrum or that gamut that you described, it is mostly in communion in itself. And as in, you know, he's looking at it from all these different angles. And he's never actually said they were ETs, and he's more pulled the other way and, you know, tried to make out that this is an unknown and we need to keep it as an unknown. So there's a contradiction in that also, as I pointed out in Beyond the Communion Enigma. He has a whole chapter about, you know, if this were an ET presence, then, you know, this, let's look at it through that lens. And so he's sort of straddled this fence of wanting to constantly be insisting that this remain in question, while at the same time, I would say, more subtly pushing for a narrative that contradicts the very thing that he's saying. You know, the rest of the time he's also said that his worst fear is that some sort of religion would grow up around what he's doing, but at the same time it's as though he's unconsciously actually encouraging that. You pointed out that, like, this movement, it's easy to see how Strieber would unwittingly be instrumental in something and not realize what he was doing simply from a desire to be helpful. So he created the website. Many other people were having experiences that somehow seemed similar. Like you said, they were triggered by the book, particularly the image on the cover, which he's since removed from the cover in more recent edition. They would write to Strieber. They would then come to his website, unknowncountry.com. There was a forum there. I've spoken to at least one person who was at that forum, who eventually got kicked off the forum when she began talking about MK Ultra and her belief that she was being mind controlled. She was systematically or summarily banned from the website for talking about that. And yet at the same time, Strieber himself has more and more, he's revealed more and more about his experiences as a child being experimented on, being tortured, being abused, entering into dissociative states, encountering the visitors as a child, thereby acknowledging.
Full stop. Explain to people that whole thing, because I had to hear it a couple times before I was really able to take it in.
He's saying that, yeah, the Randolph Air Base, his father, I know it's hard to keep track of all the different variables in Strieber's story, but I know the Strieber family, a high-level family in San Antonio, Texas.
His uncle was at Roswell.
Yeah, his own, that's right. That was the thing I was trying to remember.
Too freaky in that it fits all these stories we hear about these military families that then they show up. But, you know, his thing as a kid is just freaking unbelievable. Tell that story.
I found a video more recently about, it's just a news clip from, I guess, the 60s or something. It's black and white, about MK Ultra experiments on adolescents in San Antonio, Texas, which is really, really very striking to me, because it actually places the MK Ultra program right at the time and place of Strieber's memories, even though he disassociates them from MK Ultra for no good reason I can think of. But anyway, so his father agreed that Strieber, as a child, age 7, I believe, would be inducted into this military program, which was run by a German that he remembers, Strieber remembers, as Dr. Anthony Krauss. I think it was Anthony, Dr. Krauss, anyway. Strieber's memories are nothing if not fragmented and chaotic around everything, really. But
that would be consistent with someone who's...
It would, yeah. Yeah.
MK Ultra'd to the point where they're traumatized to, you know, the one thing that got me about the Randolph thing is that Whitley, and again, he seems like such a broke, I'm not trying to put the guy down. I think he's awesome for being this open. I could never imagine being as open as he is. And that's, I guess, part of the reason I feel like it's kind of okay to talk about him in this way, because he's kind of throwing this out there and saying, help me kind of sort through this. But you know, he recounts that one of the reasons he believes this so strongly is that he had a friend who was approached as well through his parents. So he has a friend who's also 9 years old, and the military guys, the Air Force guys, show up and they talk to the parents and they go, wow, your boy is a special boy and we have a program for him. Only the dad was kind of sharp enough to kind of ask some questions. And at some point the guy said, yeah, and there's the Skinner box and this and that, you know, BF Skinner, we're going to put him like a rat. And then, and they said, no, I don't think this is for our special kid. And I think that this fits in with Strieber's story, because he said, you know, he doesn't blame his parents, which is also kind of interesting to kind of, when you look back on this, why wouldn't you blame your parents more? But anyways, you know, he was dressed up in his Sunday best waiting for these guys to come pick him up for his special program. But then when he gets there, he sees these kids who are locked in cages and says, that's what happens to kids who tell their parents what goes on here. And then he's subjected to this horror.
Yeah. So, and Strieber's, the way that he has interpreted these experiences is the way that Jeffrey Kripal picked it up for his traumatic secret piece, which kickstarted Prisoner Infinity, which is that through the trauma, the intense distress of being subjected to these brutalities at the hands of the government, how does he describe it? His mirror of expectation was shattered. And he began to perceive other realities outside or beyond this one, and that allowed the visitors to gain access to his reality. And somehow the visitors, you know, intervened and rescued him. But what's interesting, and I think of key significance in that interpretation, is that Strieber never addresses the question of, because, you know, he claims to be an alien abductee, and abduction is a physical event, supposedly. So, but he never addresses the question as whether, as a child in that Skinner box being tormented for whatever purposes, whether he was physically taken out by the visitors. The assumption being he wasn't, because you'd think you would make a point of saying that, because it would be so remarkable if he was actually physically rescued by non-human beings from the hands of government torturers. Obviously, that's a significant development. He doesn't address the question at all. Therefore, I think one can only assume that he's not talking about a physical intervention, but a psychic one. That while his body was being traumatized, he was able to disembody or exteriorize or dissociate and enter into this other realm where he encountered these beings that he later identified as the author of Communion, as the visitors who he's been presenting to the world ever since, as, you know, in the various different ways that he's been presenting. So, I mean, this is my key question with Prisoner of Infinity, because I don't feel that I, or maybe anyone, is equipped to address the question of, you know, how real are the visitors? Because that's just such, I mean, that's like asking how real is God, you know, it's just beyond the scope of what I could study anyway. So I was just looking at Strieber's own testimony. So then the question becomes a much subtler question relating to, you know, to what extent is his experience of these visitors and his interpretation of the experience a compensatory dissociative strategy of a traumatized psyche that is generating a reality that's part fantasy, part reality, in order to, you know, escape an unbearable reality.
And there might be a lot of overlap with those two things that you said. You know, one thing that I'd love to get your comment on that just floored me, in listening to this most recent interview with Whitley on Greg Carlwood's excellent show, The Higher Side Chats. And he goes, at the end of the day, this is much, much stranger than we could possibly imagine. And again, it's one of those things that just like a throwaway line, but the way that he said it, it just struck me at a level of maybe it is at that level of impossible to understand no matter which way we approach it. And it has that, as we started this discussion, multiple realities, both created and imposed beyond our will, running through it at the same time, that make it really, really strange.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you won't get any argument from me there. I mean, that is Strieber's shtick, if I may say it that way. Like he loves to emphasize just how unbelievably strange his experience is. And yes, it is. But why does he de-emphasize the equally strange but far more mundane aspects that entail psychological trauma, abuse, government manipulations, deceptions, and so on and so forth? That's all I'm interested in doing. I'm not interested in trying to discredit or debunk his version of it. I'm simply interested in re-adding, you know, returning the ignored elements, the elements that have been kept out of the narrative because they undermine the narrative that Strieber's presenting. And it seems to be doing a disservice to the thing. Like you pointed out, Strieber's laying all this material out. He is asking us to take it seriously. But then I don't think anyone has taken Strieber as seriously as I have, to be frank. Not even Strieber himself in some ways, and certainly not Jeffrey Kripal. Like the amount of work I put into Prisoner Infinity and the amount of time and energy and love really was a sincere attempt to understand what was happening to Strieber and to make sense of his narrative. But he's not interested in it. And why? Well, because it does undermine what I call his crucial fiction. And I, of course, I'm sympathetic to that, and I'm aware it's a very delicate thing. I don't want to be bulldozing over somebody's necessary, you know, interpretation of their experience, which is partly a defense and a way to deal with it. Except, as you say, he's putting it all out there and not just inviting supposedly, you know, discussion, but also the opposite, really, as in he's asserting this is real, is one of his favorite sayings. This is real. This is really happening, folks.
Well, but at the same time, and this is to reinforce what you're saying, is he's open to, or he seems to be open to, really penetrating this on a level that includes his fragmented, broken soul that has been subjected to some really horrible stuff. I mean, because let's be fair, he's outed the Randolph experiments. He's outed the Nazi doctors. Not that Nazi doctors make any difference. You have Jewish doctors in MK Ultra, so it's not like, you know, it's kind of the nuts. It's like whoever they can get their hands on to do this stuff. I take kind of a middle ground between what you're saying in terms of, I hear you, and I'm okay with you pushing. And I'm also, I get the sense of not a guy who's intentionally trying to mislead me in Strieber, but in a guy who, because maybe that's how they've, you know, got him right now, he can't really seem to go some places that to the rest of us, after reading your book, say, why can't you go there? Why can't you go to 1968? Why can't you go to London and San Antonio and Austin and all those places? Why? It's just your timeline. Why can't you go there?
Yeah. And it's not a rhetorical question, is it? It's a real question. Why can't Strieber go there, honestly? And the answer is what I'm exploring. There are areas of his experiences, as there are for all of us, that are too threatening because we've created a narrative to deal with reality that prevents us from seeing reality as it is, and certain anomalous elements have had to be kept out of the picture because they will the narrative breaks down if we allow them into it. So that was what I undertook with Prisoner Infinity, was let's look at Strieber's narrative. Let's reintroduce the elements or reemphasize the elements that he himself has acknowledged but has de-emphasized and actually rendered irrelevant, when I would say, as is very often the case you'll find in psychotherapy, the very elements that people have de-emphasized are actually the key ones. It's the parts that people don't want to see that really reveal the most. So it's like he's created this big light show with the visitors and the zombies and the, you know, dead communications from the dead and all this psychic paranormal phenomena, which, by the way, I don't think is necessarily unreal at all. But I think that the context in which Strieber or whoever is having these experiences is as important as the experiences themselves, because once again, that would determine how wholesome, how healthy, how integrated they are as experiences, as compared to how compensatory they are as like real hallucinations, let's say, or fantasies with a pH, as in the human psyche is very powerful to generate experiences, stigmata. Those experiences are real, but that doesn't mean the person actually is channeling Christ or connecting to Christ. They might be, you know, hysterical. Their religious upbringing might have imprinted them so severely that they have this pathology that can manifest in physical symptoms. And I think, to bring it back to how we started this conversation, if I can, that this is something that can be also observed on a collective scale. If you traumatize a society while at the same time preparing for them fantasy or escapist or compensatory narratives that they can then escape into, then you will be able to actually, as it were, mine the psychic energy of a whole collective to inform those narratives, because they will want so badly to believe in them. So those two things work together. You've got this very stark and brutal reality, you know, of organized malevolence. And you have a people who's traumatized by it, who's dimly aware of it. And then you have these fantasy narratives which are based in true spiritual reality. Therefore, they have substance to them, but they've been cynically created and co-opted to provide escapes for the very same collective that's being traumatized. They will flee into them, and they will, you know, animate them. They will make them real. And I think that we're seeing something like that on a collective scale, and it's really massive and quite overwhelming in its scope. But on the other hand, what I found with Prisoner Infinity, as I said earlier, we don't have to figure out what's going on in the world and understand the whole big picture, because we never can. We only have to address the ways in which we've been unmoored from our own, the ground of our own soul and our own being, and been lured into these counterfeit spiritual or scientific or religious or magical or whatever, or artistic narratives, you know, and just withdraw little by little from them, because however close they approximate the real, they're not, because they were made by someone else.
Okay, excellent. One more to throw on the table with Whitley, and then we'll wrap up this conversation. I'm going at it for an hour and a half.
Okay.
And this is a tough one. I don't know what to make of it. And I'm challenged because it does enter the more materialistic scientific realm of extended consciousness, if you get my point. I mean, I think that's a real critical part that we both come together on, is that part of what we're seeing here from a deep state shadow government kind of thing is, these guys wanted to figure this extended consciousness stuff out, and they were going to plow into it. So, you know, remote viewing and MK Ultra are, some would argue, and I would, that part of it was the experience of encountering ET and encountering their ability to manipulate extended consciousness, and them saying, okay, this is the next frontier that we have to look at too, because we can't be caught on our feet with this. Here's the point, though. Here's the Whitley story that just scares the living crap out of anyone who hears it, which Whitley is great at. But at the same time, I get the sense in with this openness, this kind of unbelievable vulnerability that he shows, that he's telling the truth. And that's that he says that he's come to believe that these Nazi scientists who ran these horrible experiments on children, that what they were trying to do was crack into this other realm in the same way that these Nazis had cracked into accidentally in the gas chambers of Auschwitz. And he says that these guys, they counted the children and the adults too, but they counted the people that went into the gas chambers and they carefully counted the people that came out. And every once in a while, the counts did not match. And Whitley believes that if people are traumatized enough, but especially children, they can not only disassociate in the ways that we've come to understand can kind of crush a soul, but they may actually be able to shift into another dimension, another realm that puts them in contact with not only ET, but maybe a bunch of other stuff. And he speculates that perhaps that was one of the goals of this project, was to recreate that. What do you make of that?
It just seems very highly speculative. And again, it's interesting that he didn't refer to his own experience there, because was he one of those? Did he enter another dimension or did he not? And as I say, that ought to be a very pressing central question for Strieber himself, if he doesn't know it, and for his audience, if he does. So, but on the other hand, he's speculating about this that supposedly went on in Nazi concentration camps. Well, how does he know this? What's his source? You know, because one thing about Strieber, and I said, you know,
I hear you on that. But if we just kind of switch and just take the story and say, can it be totally bullshit? Can it be totally dismissed? It's like, what is his purpose for saying that story? It doesn't help anything about his.
No. But I was going to say, I don't think Strieber's a witting disinformation agent. I think he's a confabulator, and I think that that's one of the benefits, in quotes, or in a rather morbid benefits of a traumatized psyche, or traumatizing a psyche, is that it does learn to weave fantasies with all the intensity and passion and commitment of reality itself. And I mean, we see this on a low level with, you know, writers and artists tend to have dysfunctional families and difficult childhoods. That's a well-known fact. So I would say what's more interesting and less speculative is the extent to which something like MKUltra as a program understood this, that a way to create great cultural confabulators would be to traumatize them and force them to develop strategies of dissociation and fantasy that were so profound and prodigious that if they grew up to be functioning social entities, they could become very influential cultural figures. Now, you could see how problematic that would get when such figures don't just stay in the realm of horror fiction, but become horror non-fiction writers who then start speculating about, you know, Nazi experiments in concentration camps that caused interdimensional travel for children, right? Is he writing fiction at this point, or is it non-fiction? And can we trust his own judgment about that? Same with his wife, Anne. I've no doubt he sincerely believes he's in communication with her. But if he were as paranoid as someone who's been through Strieber's experiences ought to be, he would also be considering that he might be being played by other dimensional entities or by psychotronic, you know, weaponry of the CIA, rather than just, you know, blasely assume that, yes, his beloved wife is communicating to him from the other side. That there's too much of a tendency with Strieber to make the narrative so compelling and so enticing and so appealing that we'll suspend our critical faculties and just speculate along with him. And I'd say this is an example of that. Yeah, maybe the Nazis were doing something like that, but maybe they weren't. I mean, there's not much to say beyond that, is there?
Well, see, this is kind of interesting, and this is a point we could kind of really wrestle to the ground if we had more time. But yeah. I almost see that the suspension of disbelief needs to kind of switch to the other realm when you talk about after-death communication. The way that he's talking about the after-death communication with his wife, Anne, who passed a couple of years ago, is completely in line with the best, quote-unquote, science we have about after-death communication and the contact by a close friend, two close friends, after the death. And, you know, so it's totally cynical perspective could just be, well, he's just lying. He's just making that up. But it is completely consistent with everything you hear about after-death communication. The first guy who calls doesn't even know that Anne has passed and says, hey, Anne said to give you a call and contact. And the other person, you know, a day or two later does know that Anne has passed and sends that message forward. So, again, to me, that forces me to forced choice kind of thing. Either this guy is a deliberate misinformation agent, which I just don't accept. He just doesn't fit that model. He's way too open. He's way too willing to go places that wouldn't serve those interests. So he's not that. Then I gotta believe, since that phenomenon is kind of well understood, as much as we can say that, that what he's saying is true. Why wouldn't it be true? Of course, there's after-death communication. Why didn't he communicate with Anne? I don't find a solid reason not to believe that.
Well, I'd say don't believe anything until you know it. I mean, just leave it as an unknown. So that's where I'd go with that. You know, with anyone who's having communication, because I feel I've had communication with family members after they've died or other people after they've died, I still have to put a question mark on it because I don't know if it's really them. Like, I don't know that there aren't other entities or even other technologies that can assume the guise of people who've died and fool us benevolently or malevolently into believing we're in communication with the dead. Christians would say that it's demons or angels who are just using the shells of dead people to communicate with us. How would we possibly know if that were the case, right? But allowing that there's certainly something beyond our paradigm is occurring, I would say that's the case with Strieber, yeah, including this thing with Anne. The thing is with Strieber, it does seem to me that everything he's doing is useful to the socio-spiritual engineering programs as so far as I've been able to map them. I haven't seen much evidence that he's really willing to go against the grain there. So, and I'd say
tricky, Jason, because like from my experience, and you know, from a little bit of following the show, take near-death experience science. That's a great one because that has both elements. Yeah. You could say on one hand that follows the socio-spiritual engineering agenda, but it sure doesn't look like that. When that stuff hit, you know, 10 years ago or 8 years ago, man, they came out hard against that. And they haven't totally softened on it either. It's just gained so much momentum within the public sphere and public acceptance of it that they've kind of given up to a certain extent. They came out guns a-blazing against that. And so how do you, that goes back to, I think, what we were saying before. I think we have to have a nuanced thing of they have their hooks in it, but they don't know which way that bull is going to turn. And I think the same as well with after-death communication. No, I don't think they're controlling the release of that, of those findings, that data, that science, if you will, any more than they're controlling
the, it's back to the counterfeit. I mean, the people who are creating counterfeits aren't necessarily the people who create the currency, right?
Yep.
So, I mean, John Mack, he was at Harvard, so he was an insider, but then he started talking about alien abductions and he got kicked out of Harvard. So that would superficially seem to reinforce John Mack's, you know, whatever, credibility and suggest that the powers that be were trying to suppress him. But if we use that as an argument, then we've got to think that the powers that be are smart enough to know that we might use that as an argument and to know that if you're going to create a sort of grassroots movement or make something appear organic and spontaneous, you also make it appear that it's being suppressed. And I mean, that's the UFO narrative through and through, right? Supposedly the government's been trying to cover it up, but scratch the surface and no, they've actually been creating a lot of the supposed evidence that they've been supposedly covering up. So certainly you've got to allow at least those two levels, right?
I do. And I can't resist throwing one more in before we wrap it up, because it's kind of one of my things I always return to. It's the proactive versus reactive thing, because I think we can get to the same place. And that's that I think too often we associate a proactive deep state where what they're really doing is a reactive kind of thing. So the idea that they're figuring all this stuff in out in advance and running the program and operationalizing it in a perfectly orchestrated way, no, as the history suggests, that it's probably much more reactive. It's just a bunch of idiots sitting around and going, well, let's try this. And then it totally fails. And one psychopath in the back of the room says, yeah, but if we wanted to, we could kind of turn that around and we could kind of weaponize that in this way. And everyone goes, yeah, weaponize it. They didn't plan it going that way. It just went that way. And they just throw some more crap against the wall and see what sticks. But that fits in perfectly with what you've described as well. I mean, that would, in an organic way, add to the confusion of being whipsawed one way or another, you know.
Yeah, well, the same way a counterfeit, again, is the reaction to currency. If you see a currency and you realize you can't control it, well, create a counterfeit, because you will be able to control that. So yeah, in a certain sense, I would definitely agree that it's all reactive in terms of what we're talking about, organized malevolence. By definition, it's reactive. It's not able to respond organically and spontaneously to what is. It's trying to control everything. And that in itself, the desire to control or oppress or dominate is a reaction. It's like a fear response to something that is overwhelming. So yeah, if we want to sort of end on a meta note, then yeah, all of these machinations are sourced in an eventually futile and inevitably futile reactive response to something that can't be comprehended by the human mind or the human ego. It's just beyond our comprehension. But I do think there is a but to that, because that also has been part of the snare that they, these reactive idiot super genius controllers, have used to trick us into, you know, not looking more closely at the evidence. This idea that, well, we can't comprehend this anyway, right? Because, yeah, okay, you can't comprehend the ultimate nature of reality, but you can comprehend the machinations of the ruling elite and the intelligence agencies to some degree. And so that's what I attempted with Street. But there's an awful lot in his narrative that actually can be flattened out and unpacked and explained in very mundane terms. Now, what's left at the end of that? Well, that is truly anomalous.
Excellent. Our guest again has been Jason Horsley. You're definitely going to want to check out this book we've been referencing, Prisoner of the Infinity. And of course, check out his website, autoculture.com. A lot of great stuff on there. You'll just dive deep in so many areas, you probably won't be able to dig yourself out for a couple days. Jason, it's been great having you on the show. I look forward to following your work and maybe doing this again someday.
Well, thanks, Alex. I'm glad that we finally had this conversation.
Thanks again to Jason Horsley for joining me today on Skeptico. One question I'd have to tee up from this interview is, what do you make of the socio-spiritual engineering hypothesis, the claim? And in particular, what do you make of this character, Whitley Strieber, who we are going to return to a few times as the show goes on, because I think it's just such a pivotal point in history to really be unpacked and understood. And I give Jason a ton of credit for really honing in on that. So let me hear your thoughts on that. Any ideas you have, send me an email. Visit the website, Skeptico, SKEPTIKO.com. And check out all the previous shows of Skeptico that you can download for free and share for free. So that'll do it for this episode. Until next time, take care and bye for now.